The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Harry.
And on today's episode of the New Statesman podcast, we discuss how Boris Johnson is trying to relaunch himself after the confidence vote. And you ask us, why are his MPs still backing him? So I'm back. Thank you so much for holding down the fort in a very quiet couple of days of politics, really. I mean, it was just so easy for you guys, to be honest. I thought that your discussions about the confidence vote were really interesting. And now we're in the aftermath. Boris Johnson's attempting a relaunch. He's announcing some new housing policy today. We don't know the details of that yet, so we won't unpick that in any detail at the moment. But Harry,
don't know if number 10 know the detail yet.
Yeah, that probably is part of why we don't know the detail yet as well. But it doesn't really look like Boris Johnson is necessarily going to be safe for a year, which is sort of, if the rules were going to work how the rules work, that should be the case. Is that right, Harry?
Yes, I think there's a lot of talk around this. Boris Johnson, as far as I understand it, does believe he's safe for a year, and he's wrong to do so because, first of all, there are no strict rules about how the 1922 or the Tory party operate. This is all really convention or sort of lowercase r rules.
Ooh, can I do a Pirates of the Caribbean reference?
Sure.
They're more like guidelines anyway. Sorry, continue.
Exactly. It's like when you went to Blockbuster and bought things and you'd say to your mum, this is just a recommendation that you be 18 to watch this. And if you do look at those rules, then in theory, for good reason, he's safe for a year because you can't have no confidence votes every other week. But in reality, as I think we've been reporting for a while, as soon as a majority of Tory MPs want another vote in Boris Johnson, they'll get one. And the way that will happen is the 1922 committee can at any time decide to hold another vote. And the executive of the committee, which is a small group of about 17 at the moment, can theoretically decide to do one tonight. And there is actually a majority, I understand, of rebels on that group of 17. There are 9 rebels, 7 that support Johnson and 1 who's unknown. So in theory, they could do it. Now, they're not going to do it just now. We just had a vote. But the idea that it can't happen is wrong. And you only have to go back to 2019 when Theresa May had survived the no confidence vote in December. And by May of 19, the 1922 executive at the time met and held a vote on whether to have another no confidence motion against her. And they took the results of that decision to number 10, and they said to May, we're going to open this envelope and very likely have another no confidence vote in you unless you resign. And so she resigned.
Okay, and that was before the year was up, wasn't it? So that was a way of forcing her hand.
That was less than 6 months.
Yeah. And there's always this feeling, I think, this complacent feeling, really, that confidence votes which result in the Prime Minister winning can be a sort of cleansing moment, and so they can get back to doing what they want to do and the matter's settled. I remember listening to an interview with Gavin Barwell, who was Theresa May's chief of staff at the time, of her confidence vote, and he was saying that they were so keen to get to one that they were actually considering putting in votes of no confidence themselves as her supporters to try and bring one closer so that they could get on with their agenda. But it never actually works like that, does it? And Boris Johnson has made so many statements recently saying that he wants to get back back to the business of government. But now there's a sense that nobody really believes him when he announces new policies or suggests that he's going to cut taxes.
I think we had the first Boris Johnson relaunch in June 2020, which was when the government was getting some criticism for its handling of the pandemic. We certainly had some in the autumn of 2021, and then basically since Partygate broke and the Owen Paterson scandal broke, it almost feels every week there's a new relaunch, there's a new headline about things like, we talked about this last week, I think, bonfire of EU regulations, which basically is code for we're still governing and doing the things you want to. Honest, I think it might be possible, theoretically, to go back to your agenda and for the government to say, yeah, we're going to get on with the hard work of governing, if they had an agenda, which they don't at the moment. They're lurching from policy to policy. We can't blame the Tory government entirely for the economic crisis and inflation and war with Ukraine. There are a lot of external forces, but they don't really have that much they can do, or certainly that much that they are doing to combat any of that. So you're not getting a kind of coherent policy agenda, which means that it's very difficult to go to the party and to MPs and say, we've had this confidence vote, now let's get on with the job, like, you know, Margaret Thatcher was doing. She had a vision, she had a policy set of strategies, people knew where they were going. We've got grammar schools, we're going to bring those back, some imperial measurements, which we'll possibly talk about a bit about later, and we're going to solve the housing crisis. How? We're not sure. We're not going to do a windfall tax. We are going to do a windfall tax. We're going to call it something else. What are they asking for renewed mandate to do, except for to continue trying to cling on to power?
Yes, and actually it's really difficult, isn't it, to try and pander to certain policy asks in this rebellion, because Harry, as you wrote in your very good piece that I suggest our listeners all go and listen to about why Boris Johnson is wrong to believe he's safe for a year, you reckon that a majority of backbenchers did put in letters of no confidence, right? That it was more on that side than the payroll side. Mm-hmm. And if that's true, that's a huge mix of different politics, isn't it? So if you announce the sending asylum seekers to Rwanda policy, that's going to piss some people off. If you announce the windfall tax, that's going to piss some other people off. There's One Nation Tories in there who are really disaffected. There's ERG members in there who are really disaffected. At least for Theresa May, she knew which faction to pander to, which mm-hmm. was the sort of Brexit ultras. But it makes it really difficult for Boris Johnson and his team to know which backbenchers' tummies to tickle, basically.
That's not an image that I wanted.
There's a great Chekhov quote, when many remedies are suggested for a disease, it cannot be cured. And that's a bit like where we are now with him and the government. And Rachel and I talked about possible numbers of rebels on Monday. It's just worth mentioning for our listeners, this is right at the top end of the expectations we were talking about. This 148 rebels is one more in today's terms proportionally than against Thatcher. And she had gone by now, announced her resignation 48 hours later. And here we are more than 48 hours later and he's acting like nothing's happened. I think he's definitely in deep trouble and it's probably not going to be before the summer recess. So there's the by-elections in a few weeks, but probably unlikely that the 1922 think the mood has changed enough to move towards another vote. And so you're probably looking at something in the autumn. And just to flag, the committee I'm talking about, which on which there's a majority for the rebels, will be re-elected in the autumn. And that vote, well, as one person said to me, essentially be a no confidence vote proxy, because rebels will put through a slate of MPs who back changing the rules and they will try and get those people put on. And crucially, people on the government payroll, the strict government payroll, let's not get into that. That's 95 MPs. They won't be able to vote. And so only the backbenchers will. And there's a majority of rebels on the backbenchers. So I'd be quite confident that the rebels will be able to get their committee elected in the autumn and therefore change the rules if they would like later this year.
That's so interesting.
I'm really looking forward to the prospect of the committee executive changing the rules and Boris Johnson and his supporters saying this is totally unfair and undemocratic and how can you change the rules midway through? And you're thinking, didn't you just change the ministerial code? I'm really looking forward to Nadine Dorries' response to that. Yeah.
They're only learning from the master.
I still think the high point this week has been her interview where I'm baffled that MPs think they can do this. It's the rule book of your party. This is how it works. Didn't didn't you do this, Theresa May, a couple of years ago? Do you have amnesia? Should you really be culture secretary if you have amnesia? But just the way she and other sort of diehard Boris Johnson supporters are just able to twist things and seem very happy to make statements like that on TV. I do think that they're a minority, though, that there's Nadine Dorries and there's Jacob Rees-Mogg and there are some others who seem committed to the Boris project. There are a lot of other cabinet members who seemed very uncomfortable about being asked to support the Prime Minister, or who managed to do so in words that you can always almost imagine they've got their fingers crossed behind their back. I think Harry's probably right in that the majority of votes against him came from the rebels, and I can see why if you're on government payroll you would feel like maybe you should vote for him. But I don't think that enthusiasm is particularly warm or particularly genuine, shall we say.
Just on that, so I think at the start of this year, it takes a while to get ready to get rid of the PM if you're in the cabinet. And at the start of this year, other contenders weren't ready to be PM, though they all believe, as people like to say, that they can be. But I think by the end of this year, especially now that we see how weak Boris is and they have the whole summer to prepare, you'll get much more of a feeling among potential top cabinet ministers that they should now move. And so I think that's why a second vote or something like that later in this year becomes very likely, because I think the crucial constituency here is those cabinet ministers and their teams in their party who currently have backed the Prime Minister because they're not ready to jump, but later in this year might be ready to move.
And are those sort of alternative leadership campaigns galvanising now that we've had this very bad outcome for the Prime Minister?
It's really too early to tell because we're less than 72 hours after, but they will be for sure. And we'll see that starting to happen over there, I think, the next 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And I think just looking at the numbers, even if you thought that he was going to win, and he did, I think everyone on both sides was quite shocked at how high that number went, and I get the impression that there's still a lot of anger and confusion as to how Downing Street and how the whips let it get to that point and lost control to that degree. Yeah. Would that be right, Harry?
Yeah, I think that's true. They wanted to keep it under 100, and the range the rebels were briefing was 115 to 145, so that's just outside at the top end of the range. I'm not sure what the whips could really do, in the sense that it's so hard to identify the rebels because they're everywhere.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Nadine Dorries, actually, because it turns out that some of these hardcore supporters like her and Jacob Rees-Mogg are turning out to be quite a liability for the Prime Minister. We've spoken about this before, many episodes back, about how some of these cheerleaders are shooting their own leader in the foot, in a way. And that came up at PMQs, actually. Keir Starmer quoting Nadine Dorries' comments that it was years of Conservative government that meant that the government was unprepared for the pandemic. And those were comments that were aimed at Jeremy Hunt, who is a potential sort of leadership hopeful. But do you think it worked? Do you think Keir Starmer has weaponized that line of attack effectively?
The failings of the past 10 years. Well, this is what he was trying to do in PMQs. And a lot of people were unimpressed by the way Keir failed to skewer Boris yesterday. But the Labour line is, we need to blame all Tories for what's happened over the last decade plus. And their fear is that they pin too much blame on Johnson and then he goes and the Tory party somehow move on. Well, okay, you can see the rationale for that. But I think the big problem with it is Keir so often fails, seemingly, in these big moments in PMQs. And it leads to a narrative that builds up that he's weak or esoteric in his manner and in his questions. And I think it would be so much more effective for the Labour Party if the press were impressed by Keir each week than if they were finding him so curious in his approach.
Mm. So I'm going to do a rare thing and defend Keir Starmer's PMQ's
performance,
actually. Keir Starmer. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. No, you
two against one, Harry.
You go first.
But yeah, I think going on the NHS is, I understand why people might have thought that it made him look like he wasn't going for the jugular because of what had just happened in the past 72 hours, like you say, Harry. What's happening here is that we've got two by-elections coming up very soon, and the NHS, I've heard in Tiverton and Honiton in particular, is a big issue for voters. So it's got the worst ambulance delays in Devon, and people are bringing it up a lot, because it's in those kind of rural areas where there is sort of rural poverty and services have been stripped away, where people are most concerned about the state of the health service. These things are political calculations, and I think the NHS is high up on the agenda. Someone like Jeremy Hunt, who wants to have another crack at the leadership, has been talking about it so much, written a book about it. Obviously, he has that experience as having been health secretary as well, but he knows that's going to be a big issue in an upcoming general election. And look at the waiting list, it's at a record high. So I do think that if Labour can get on the front foot talking about GPs, talking about these minor irritations in people's lives, you can't get an appointment with your GP, you can't even ring up the surgery, you can't register as a NHS patient at a dentist anymore. These things add up to make you feel like the country is just not working how it should. And that could have the impact, like you say, Harry, which is Labour's aim, to get people fed up with Conservative government rather than just fed up with Boris Johnson, the man, because there is a long Corbyn effect out there, as you hear. And so it is important for them to damage the Conservative brand as well as the sort of personal reputation of the Prime Minister.
I would agree with all of that. I would also say that if you think that your next opponent is likely to be Jeremy Hunt, which it might well be, then going hard on the... Harry is shaking his head, it won't be Jeremy Hunt. But if you think that it might be Jeremy Hunt, then going hard on the NHS and all of the NHS problems that long precede Boris Johnson is probably a smart move. The other thing I would say is that I think Labour are just still a bit stunned, maybe perhaps is the wrong word, but they've noticed how Boris Johnson was able to, after 10 years of Tory rule, basically act like a new government and a fresh start. And he kind of managed to blame all of the issues on previous Tory prime ministers, even though there are a lot of the same people in the cabinet, even though he was in the cabinet at one point, he was in Theresa May's cabinet. But he was just amazingly adept in the first part of being prime minister before the pandemic, of sort of wiping the slate clean. And if I were Labour, I'd have noticed that, and I'd be a bit concerned that a new leader might be able to do the same thing and say, yeah, Boris was useless, but I didn't back Boris. Look, I'm a new kind of Tory PM, and that record wouldn't count. Now, I'm not sure who it would be who'd be able to do that. And obviously Boris is something of a special case. But you do want to make the point that they've been in power for 12 years. The country is falling apart with the NHS, with ambulance delays, with food prices, with shortages of drivers, with the passport office. I could do an entire podcast just on the issues with the passport office or the DVLA. Like, all of these problems have stacked up because of 12 years of party rule. So making the continuity point. But I also agree with Harry that it was a bit of an anticlimax. And if he was going to go after Boris in a different way, he should have been able to do it in a sharper and more effective, more polemic kind of style, which he wasn't able to do.
Yeah, and I just think it's all about how you think voters engage with politics. Do you think they're watching PMQs, or do you think they engage with politics by reading the reactions to PMQs? That's also another part of it. And if the press are all going to react badly to what you've done, is it that effective for you to say, well, the voters were watching and they were impressed? And I think the next Tory leader will probably try and reinvent himself anyway, and I'm not, or herself, I'm not quite sure that Keir's oblique tack at PMQs is going to change that. But we could talk about PMQ strategy all day.
Hi, it's Anoush here. This is just a reminder that as a podcast listener, you have the option of subscribing to The New Statesman with a very special offer. You can subscribe for just £1 a week. That's 12 weeks for £12 if you go to newstatesman.com/podcast offer. We'll be right back.
From The New Statesman comes a new podcast, Audio Long Reads, the best of our reported features and essays read aloud.
Songs are like tattoos, Mitchell said on Blue. Having one written about you is immortality and fiction rolled into one.
Featuring writing from our authors, including Kate Mossman on Joni Mitchell's former muse and lover, Jeremy Cliff on his journey through France before this year's presidential election, and Sophie McBain on the refugee crisis.
Don't die, he kept shouting. He didn't answer when Mardwa screamed back, who is dying?
Ease into the weekend with our audio long reads, published every Saturday morning. Just search Audio Long Reads wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So we have an interesting question today from Tom. Thanks for writing in. He asks, how exactly would you break down the motivations for MPs coming out to support Boris Johnson? This is really interesting because we've been talking a lot about the rebels, but not so much about those who are supporting him. And Tom adds, how do you compare this breakdown to Theresa May's backing during the 2019 confidence vote? So I think starting out, what's interesting is that you do have, we've already talked about this, you do have such a mix of rebels, i.e. from different parts of the party with different philosophies and who are disaffected for different reasons. But I think it's the same for those who are in support. So I was speaking to someone on the One Nation sort of side of the party recently who was saying, look, Boris Johnson is the only leader likely of all the alternatives who is going to spend the money that we want to be spent on the services and infrastructure projects that we want fixed and that we think will make the country a fairer place to live. And so there is a reluctance among some figures who you might expect to be people who find his sort of personal style of leadership or his character tasteless to sort of stick with him as the best of a bad bunch because he will sign off on those projects that are more to their taste and they have to hold their nose through the more populist, perhaps nastier policies. We mentioned the Rwanda deal in the last section. So I think that's an interesting aspect of it that stood out to me when I've been speaking to people.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's quite useful to have a weak prime minister because you can bully them. So there's lots of people who think we can use Boris Johnson to our ends. I think the other reason people vote for him, there are a minority of supporters, but there are also people in Red Wall seats who think there's no alternative prime minister who has any chance of letting them hold on to their seats, even though they're a lot of them set to lose their seats by 10 points plus at the moment. And I think finally, obviously, there's the extraordinary power of patronage. And if you publicly come out and support Boris Johnson at his low moment, you too may be able to become an unpaid parliamentary private secretary.
Is there no greater honour?
Who would be an MP, seriously? I think the numbers who are true believers in him and what he stands for at the moment, if they were ever that high, is very low, because one thing that we have really learned from the time that he's been in power is that he doesn't seem to stand for anything other than being in power. There were a lot of Conservatives I know who supported him, or some who even worked with him when he was London mayor, who said he is a progressive, liberal, kind of centre-right, moderate mayor, and that's a global Britain, global London. That's the kind of person, politician that he is, who were really quite shocked with the form of Brexit that was pursued and a lot of the decisions on immigration and Rwanda you mentioned, and on crime and policing. A lot of Tory MPs who were absolutely horrified with the policing bill, for example, and the restrictions on peaceful protest. And I think what we have learned is that, if you didn't know it already, he will sort of twist and shapeshift and come out in support of whatever's popular at the time, and you can't trust it. Now, what that means is that if you're in the right place at the right time, maybe you can convince him to back whatever your pet issue is. And it's not, say, a Margaret Thatcher figure, where if you went and talked to her and you made your case, she was still going to do what she wanted to do because she had a very clear, very strong vision, which he doesn't have. Maybe that's useful, but not because you ultimately believe that he is the best person to run the country just because he is the least bad option. I think, just going back, it's probably just Nadine Dorries and Jacob Rees-Mogg who actually think he is the best person to run the country. And then finally, and I know that no one has naked ambition like an MP, and if you were given the chance to be prime minister, you know, they would probably all grab it. But now is not the best time to take over as Tory leader, with 12 years in power, all of the economic headwinds that we've already discussed, all of the legacy issues. If you were a bright, young, up-and-coming sort of MP in a junior role, it might be best to stick with Boris, lose the next election, spend time out of power, and then make the next steps of your career when the party's in the ascendancy again. I can see Harry disagreeing with me violently. That would be the smart thing to do.
But hang on, I very strongly remember the day of the 2010 election, walking along my road and someone who lived nearby who worked vaguely with the Labour Party saying, it's a good election to lose. That was in 2010. It's now 2022. The Labour Party have not been in power since then. When you have power, you hold on to it with your fingertails. There's no election to lose. They're all terrible to lose. Once you lose, you're out. And then we don't pay attention to you for a long time and the other party are in charge. You just have to get in control and seize the ship of state, reinvent government, et cetera, et cetera. I really strongly believe that, just as a strategic point.
Also a moral point. You're not asking people to vote for you not to win, right?
Yeah, I think so.
You should have a vision for the country that you think that you ought to.
I don't think
they have that though.
I hear what you're saying, Rachel, but it's so cold in the wilderness. Ask the Labour Party. But
maybe that's why I would never be an MP.
But just lastly on this, the people who are sticking by him, is part of it because the potential alternatives or those who could run in a leadership election are saying things that spook different parts of the party? So Tobias Elwood talking about the single market, for example, does that suddenly make some Brexit-minded potential rebels think, oh, actually, I can't risk us going down this path again? And equally, Liz Truss, sort of a libertarian stalwart, really. Do people really want that kind of economic policy now for the context that we're living in? That might freak out some of those who are slightly more economically to the left, those who represent 2019 so-called red wall seats.
I'm not going to answer that question. I'm going to let Harry answer that question. I'm just going to say that it's not just Tobias Elwood. He said we should rejoin the single market. We actually had arch Brexiteer Daniel Hannan saying we should never have left it, which John Elledge has written in a very, I think, very funny piece this week that you can read. Read the about turn of Dan Hannan. If only somebody had said stay in the single market, and now I will be quiet and let Harry answer the question.
I'm also a huge John Elledge fan, so I'll add to that. But I know I have been told that Tobias Elwood's comment cost three rebels, that one prominent backer on the day and two others didn't vote against Johnson because they thought, I can't vote for this man Elwood and his ridiculous policy of going back into the single market. But I actually think I'd push against this idea that lots of people have, which is that Rishi's downfall made it harder to get rid of Boris. I think in some ways it made it easier because so many people could then believe in their person and their vision of, it's a bit like Brexit, they could believe in their version of Brexit, their version of the future Tory party, if you don't know what the future is. So I think the fact that it's a wide open field makes it easier in some ways.
Because you can just project whatever you want from your leader on whoever might emerge from the contest.
You can just believe that your leader is going to come through, or you're going to be Minister for Housing in that person's government or whatever it is. Whereas if it's the Rishi show, then you think, I'm not going to fit in that show, so why would I vote for him or vote to get rid of Boris?
Finally, we've had a listener clarification and correction. This is from Dr. Brendan Theaker, who has told us that he is born in 1972, which is relevant. Dear podcast, I was interested to hear the debate about metric versus imperial units. For clarification, firstly, miles and kilometres are measures of distance, not speed. Speed is distance divided by time, hence kilometres per hour or miles per hour. Secondly, when measuring horses, one hand equals 4 inches, so it is imperial. Thank you very much, Brendan. That was my error on horses, and I think all of our errors on speed and distance. But I think what we've learned from this is that the New Statesman podcast team does not understand imperial measurements and will not
We're be far too youthful
and will not be succeeding in this brave new world order where we are saying farewell to the metric system. So thank you.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and my colleagues, Rachel Cunliffe and Harry Lambert. We're produced by Adrian Bradley, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to subscribe and leave us a nice review.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.